for those looking to live outside the box of religious performance and inside the love of an awesome Father, this is The God Journey. Well, it's time to pack the old bags, grab the passport, head down to LAX, and catch another airplane. As I've been preparing to do it this time around, I'm thinking, man, it's been a long time. It's been a long time for me anyway to be home, to not have to pack all the things that need to be packed. And I've really enjoyed, this has been a great season to just be home, writing, enjoy my family, enjoy life as it unfolds here locally for us. And it's been fun to get involved in some things that way that's been good. But now it's time to go again. And many of you know, headed off to Israel this week with about 40 people. Don't like to talk about this one a whole lot because it's, you know, I realized when we started this, I didn't even know if I knew 40 people who could afford to go to the Holy Land. It's a bit of a cost and, you know, to get people there. But I tell you, it's for those who were able to take the time and did have the resources to go on this trip. And I look down the list of people that are going to be meeting me in Jerusalem here in a few days. And I'm really excited. This is a good bunch of people in great space on their spiritual journeys, going to get to spend some time together. And I think it'll be as much fun sharing life in the bus and over meals and standing around by the shore of Galilee as it will be being in the Holy Land and seeing some of the sights that we'll see there. And that's what I'm excited about. I'm excited about people connecting with each other. The event we did in Ireland a number of years ago, or 100 more folks got together in a field in Ireland for a week long, just a chance to smash hearts and heads and meet each other. And I hear all the time about relationships that still continue from that week we spent in Ireland together. And then there was one in England not too long after that. And we talked about loneliness a few weeks ago and got some input. There's some more dialogue going on there. I've got one letter I'm going to read you in a moment. But I tell you, one of the ways to connect with people on this journey is to make the choice to connect somehow, somewhere. And sometimes that happens when I travel to other places, and I don't mean Israel or even overseas, but just people invite me to come hang out with them for a weekend. The kind of people that make connections from that stuff is still, I think, so valuable for people. And yes, it does take a little bit of a priority, and I'm going to make it happen. And it does take that. I've been in places where I'll get emailed the next day, I couldn't make it to your meeting. I would like to know some of the people that were there. And I'm like going, well, you didn't make it. Why didn't you make it? And short of being in a hospital, this is how relationships connect. They connect because there's proximity and there's the willingness even for, I've been in meetings where people have driven 250, 300 miles, six states over just because they wanted that connection. And so I think that's the most valuable thing I think I travel for. And I share stuff and people want to explore various parts of this journey, their freedom from, you know, religious performance and those kinds of things. But I honestly think what's most valuable is the people who live near each other, who don't know each other, get to meet each other. And for most of the travel I do going forward here after I get back from Israel and get this book finished, and then probably going to be saying yes to a lot more invitations than I've been saying yes to in a while, the biggest joy I have is let's get people in an area together, let them connect, let them get to know each other. We did that in Kentucky early in the summers. People came up from Nashville, came up that far, but the connections, and a bunch of people stayed in the same home overnight and they really connected. And you hear about that conversation that goes on past those moments. I was on Skype this morning with someone who was part of the Irish event, and we were talking about friends and friends of friends and the connection that happened. It's great stuff. There's a lot of ongoing input on the loneliness thread. And I like a lot of where that goes. I like that people are realizing loneliness isn't necessarily the problem of not having people near me. Loneliness points to something else. I can be alone and not lonely. That kind of thought. Tammy wrote this: I'm not quite sure that I suffered from loneliness, but I clearly went through a period of about 4 or so years of wishing and praying that the Father would bring me into the path of other like-minded folks. It just didn't happen. And for great reason, now that I look back on it, I'm so aware now of all that Father was and still is pruning in me, not the least of which was my dependence on man's opinion in order to validate my spiritual experience and ability to hear Papa's voice for myself. Wow, I am so over that need and able to see through in ever-increasing degrees the level of deceit that must be in place in order to feed that beast. though I'm sure I could go on here for time's sake, I'll just say that my conclusion about the lonely period of my life is this. For me, and maybe for others, I would have to say that the length of time spent in the proverbial desert, apart from the influence of others and thus feeling somewhat alone, directly correlated with the depth of my twistedness and the soul's desire for outside approval, for validation, for value, and even wisdom. Yes, Papa wants to free us from such so that we can fully experience the love that He is. He will unravel us. For some, it may take longer than others, but I've come to believe that this freedom is absolutely worth the wait. Now, I love that, and I can understand people who say, look, I want to find like-minded, like-hearted people. And I think, yeah, look, keep your eyes and ears and hearts open so when you cross paths with people, that connects. But God speaking into your life doesn't depend on that. I just had breakfast the other morning. Not breakfast. We met for late afternoon coffee, by the way. Well, I don't drink coffee, so we had water. But there's a – and I told you this before on the podcast. I've met a local pastor here recently. We had crossed paths because of an errand thing. It wasn't even trying to meet each other. But in the course of our talking to each other, I have really enjoyed the hunger of this man's heart. And I've been with him now 4 or 5 times since. We've shared our lives together. We've shared our frustrations, our growing edge. He's always asking about my book. He's really interested in the things I am thinking and writing and my experience as a pastor and why I'm not there anymore. Even got up one Sunday morning here recently and just felt like, you know what, I'm going to go over there because I just want to see what his deal is about. And I just kind of get a sense of him and his own environment. So I went to a service on a Sunday morning and, yeah, that was, I tell you, if you forget how much you don't miss that, go once in a while. And I just, oh man, I just, you know, we always talk about the church being a family and a body. And, you know, I walk into this place as a total stranger and I went alone and there was no one that engaged me in any way. I mean, people look at you and nod and say hi, but nobody just, hey, how you doing? And I think about that in my own home. Would somebody walk into my home and I not, hey, who are you? How are you? Welcome. I mean, probably wouldn't be here if I didn't invite them, but if they did just show up. And, you know, I look around at that kind of thing and I'm going, yeah, we're doing something that somebody said is important for us to do. We talk about being a family, but man, the rigidity of an hour and a half, not quite an hour and a half of going through these processes, man, I wanted to be there for him. I wanted to hear him share what he shared from the scriptures, which I thought was really, really good. And then we had lunch after, or we had this time recently. I keep saying lunch. I almost always meet people for lunch, but this was just sitting down. And I came away from saying, I feel so stimulated in my heart being near someone like that. And it's the integrity of his journey. It's the integrity of his struggle. And it's the things he's seeing and hoping and, you know, my heart goes out to him. At one point, he was just saying, you know, I've got to learn to be a better manager. And I said, really, what's that about? And he said, well, you know, the thing's growing and there's more people and the organizational thing's lacking. Because he's just a guy that really wants to hang out with people and help them get the journey. He's not like most pastors I've known out of my tradition. I mean, the day the fires are raging around here, he's running around to people's homes that are part of that fellowship that he knows, seeing what he can do to move stuff out, to defend some homes, to get people relocated. And when I heard about his day with the recent fires, almost a year ago now, but the fires that were out here, I just go, you know what, that's the kind of heart you want. But he's also going through this, I've got to organize more, and there's a struggle that, you know, a lot of pastors go through. In fact, we've done some of these stats before, but they ran across my desk again this week. This is from Francis Schaeffer Institute, a survey they did, and this, I believe, in 2007. And I got these from the website expastors.com. That's expastors.com. And it just talks about, you know, 90% of pastors report working between 55 and 75 hours a week, 50% unable to meet the demands of the job, 70% of pastors feel grossly underpaid, 90% feel like they were inadequately trained. Many pastors struggle with depression and discouragement. 70% of pastors constantly fight depression. Wow. 50% feel so discouraged that they would leave the ministry if they could, if they had any other way of making a living. That means half of the 1,700 or so pastors who leave the ministry each month have no other way to make a living. Now, I don't think that's true. What I have discovered, I know many people from my travels and people who write me, people who have been in the ministry, quote unquote, been pastors, and leave it. And the idea that they don't have anything else to do with their Bible degrees isn't really true. The world puts a value on someone who's led a volunteer organization, who has teaching skills, who has people management skills. I find former pastors in just about every kind of job imaginable, from HR to training for organizations to entrepreneurs starting their own, God giving them wisdom to start their own business. I really think people feel trapped. And I remember thinking that when I was thinking about jumping out of this thing, what would I do to make a living? I thought about my writing skills, whatever. Didn't have any idea that some of that would be in mediation and doing some of the work I did with bridge builders for a while. There are so many ways God provides for people. There's so many things. I think these gifted people who are up and have incredible gifts and just speak to the same crowd week after week and never engage the wider community. I don't want that lie to go on. There's nothing else you can do. You got a Bible degree. You're stuck there. No, you're not. There's 1,000 things God could give you a way to do in this world, and the world will put more value on your skills than often we do ourselves. 80% of ministry feel like their family was negatively impacted by what they do. 80% of spouses feel the pastor is overworked, left out, and underappreciated by the folks in the congregation. 70% do not have someone they consider a close friend. Wow, and 40% report serious conflict with a parishioner at least once a month. So then the upshot of all is this. 50% of the ministers starting out will not last 5 years. One of every 10 will actually retire as a minister in some form. So the pain of that is incredible. What that position does, the expectations on it, and I think what it pushes people to be and do. I tell you, the best thing I ever did was to get out of that role, for sure. This from 2012, a Lifeway research, similar thing. I'm just going to quote a couple of the factors here. It says, one of the key symptoms of pain experienced by pastors is discouragement. Over 55% are presently discouraged. And then it says, loneliness factor. More pastors experience intense loneliness at times. When we conduct our survey, over one half, again, it's coincidentally the same number, 55%, which means there's probably a lot of overlap there, said they were lonely. Again, remember, this survey was for a specific point in time. Younger pastors are more likely to be lonely than older pastors. The larger the church, the greater the likelihood the pastor is experiencing loneliness. You wouldn't think that's true, would you? The larger it is, the more... You wouldn't think that's true, would you? The larger it is, the lonelier. That makes sense to me, because I think when you end up at the top of a pyramid, you end up pretty much alone. And also said the greater education level, that's interesting, the more likely he is to be lonely. So loneliness isn't just for folks that some of you have battled and you kind of get away from that institution and all your friends were religious friends and now you don't have them. It also is for people inside. If I was given to loneliness, I'd have been pretty lonely showing up that morning, hoping for a connection. Even the people I tried to engage, it was very perfunctory, and they just went on to whatever else they were there for that day. And, man, I don't think it's because people don't want to try and do well. I just think that system doesn't work well for that. This was a commentary in the Washington Post from Tom Eric. He's an Episcopal priest in New York. And he wrote a commentary in the Washington Post January 7th, said this, "Church shouldn't be this hard." That's the title of it. He said, "After 36 years of serving churches as a pastor and consultant, I came to a startling conclusion the other day. Not startling to you, perhaps. I might be the last person to get this memo, but the conclusion drew me up short. My conclusion? Religion shouldn't be this hard." I agree a lot of what he says here. Then he makes a statement like that. I'm going, yeah, religion should be that hard. Religion is not what God asked us to do. Religion was not asking us to perform for God and try and earn our acceptance from him. Religion is man's creation to try to get to God. Now, I know he doesn't mean it that way, but that's how I see it. And I know how people quote this strange scripture. Here's pure and undefiled religion. Well, yeah, so you're going to find a positive use of the word. It's in there. But what he's asking people to do is care for widows and orphans, which isn't anything like most of what our religious stuff is, which is about the performance side of it. He goes, an assembly that exists to help people wouldn't be so willing to hurt people by declaring them worthless, unacceptable, undesirable, or strangers at the gate. An assembly that should relax into the serenity of God's unconditional love shouldn't be so filled with hatred and fear. An assembly that should do what Jesus did shouldn't be so inwardly focused, so determined to be right, so eager for comfort, so fearful of failing. An assembly that allows an itinerant rabbi shouldn't be chasing permanence, stability, and property. An assembly whose call is to oneness and to serving the least shouldn't be perpetuating hierarchies of power and systems of preference. Oh, love that. No. And I know there's a lot of shouldn't on himself here, and I think that's just the religious content. We shouldn't do this. We should be doing that. We should. Why don't we just find our way into a better reality? And he goes on, faith should be difficult. Yes, because it inevitably entails self-sacrifice and renewal. Life, too, is difficult. Dealing with mammon is difficult, or money. Speaking truth to power is difficult. Confronting our own weakness and capacity for sin is difficult. But the institution whose sole justifiable purpose is to help us deal with those difficulties shouldn't be making matters worse. Yes, I understand that the church is a human institution, and here is where I disagree with my friend Tom. I like his heart, honestly. The church is not a human institution, and when we keep thinking it is, we're going to end up with the very thing we're ending up with. The church is the divine community of brothers and sisters who are living in the life of the new creation. That's the church. It's not humans who've created these institutions and called them church. And when we think it's an institution first, then all of our priorities go the wrong way. If it's a reality inside a relationship with Christ. So helping people be part of the church is to help them engage Christ. It's not to make them part of my conformity-based institution. And all institutions are conformity-based. That's the problem he's having earlier in this thing. Yeah, we shouldn't be this way. We should have a place of unconditional love. You can't have unconditional love and press people to conformity, not of doctrine, not of practice, not of ritual. The two are mutually exclusive. And until we understand that, we're going to keep doing what we've done. We have these human institutions. We call them the church, and we forever grouse with the fact that they fail. And those that lead it are discouraged and lonely and hurt, and only a few get to the top of the thing and make all kinds of money and hire all kinds of staff to do whatever they want to do. And everybody wants to be those guys. But he said, I understand the church is a human institution. Well, if you'd lose that understanding, Tom, I think the rest of it might be incredibly helpful. But he says, and therefore it will participate in humanity's brokenness. Now, I think brothers and sisters in Christ participate in the world's brokenness. That's obviously true. I know of no perfect Christian on the planet. None. So we do participate in the brokenness of the world. But the church as a reality exists inside the new creation. And it's that reality that brings healing and freedom and joy and life to our communion with each other. He says the church should be seeking to redeem that humanity. I think the church, the true church, does seek to redeem humanity, to heal the brokenness, to show better ways to live. Instead, we celebrate our own cruelty and bigotry. We fight against the very transformation that God seeks. Maybe I'm the last one to see this dilemma. The millions who are fleeing institutional Christianity in America aren't escaping bad doctrine, shoddy performance values, or inconvenient calls to mission. They're escaping the institution itself. Now, here's a statistic from one of these, the thing I got from expastors.com. I didn't read this one earlier, but it said 4,000 new churches begin each year and 7,000 close. So people are leaving it in droves. All the statistics show that people are saying this isn't, they are escaping the institution itself. And I'm saying, great. But Wayne, not all those people that are escaping are actually getting on to a life in Jesus. A lot of them are just going to the world and to their own indulgence and getting lost in the distraction of the world. And I say even great to that, because I think what religion does is it holds us in this lukewarm state. We talk about a God we don't love and don't follow, don't know how to love because we haven't been loved by him. And I'm going to follow that theme through in a little bit. And because of that, I think that's that lukewarm state that Revelation talks about. Better that you're hot, passionate for Jesus, or cold. Just go serve yourself for a while. Why? Because you will come to the end of that. Serving yourself will lead you to a broken place. And maybe in that broken place, it's the prodigal. Go, go. If you want to take this, go. If you want to spend it on yourself, go. Go get to the end of that, because obviously you're not going to know what's here at this home until you're in a pig pen and can come to your right mind. So I'm not even saying it's good they're all leaving because they're all doing something better. They're doing something more honest. And maybe that's what's better. So he says, it doesn't have to be this way. God certainly doesn't want it this way. Well, I don't know about that either, Tom. Christ should be different from the church should be different from society. There, it is different, Tom. Instead, he says, it plays by the same rules. Get mine, be first, be right, punish the weak, exclude the different, reward the wealthy. Our society needs healthy faith communities. Boy, do they. But are we ever going to find it institutionally? And it doesn't mean believers can't cooperate together, can't even have a place and an identity or of love and life together in a regular sense of gathering. I'm not against any of that, except that it becomes religious and conformity-based, and now it's not healing brokenness in the world. It's celebrating its own sense of identity and purpose. And that identity and purpose is not found in Christ and the new creation. It's found on what we can do to do good stuff or whatever. And I love that people are getting free. I love that Tom at some point sees through the curtain. And yet his answer, because the church is an institution after all, we got to fix this. And the only tools you have to fix it are still conformity based. We should do better. We should do this. We should do that. And until we free people to a better journey, until we free people to find out, number one, do they even want to know this God? Is this God worth knowing? Or is he just someone we're trying to suck up enough to get the goodies of heaven versus hell at the end of the age? And I think that's a huge mistake. Is he worth loving for himself? And if he is, how can you help me know him? Because it's the knowing of him that allows the church to take life in the world. It's the knowing of his love. It's the resting in the reality of the Father's affection. Someone sent me a link this week to a video, and I watched it. I don't know the man. He's got a website about parenting skills, and I don't know if it's Christian-based or not. I just listened to this clip that I'm going to play for you. I've got to tell you, this clip is good. This guy, and I don't want you to just, it's about parenting, certainly. But he talks about how until we rest in love, we can't grow. And I want you to see this, not just from the parent to the child. And even the person who sent me the link said, put this in God's mouth toward his children. And now we see how important it is that we rest in his love for growth to happen. Here's Gordon Neufeld. Why Children Need Rest, from a DVD called Relationship Matters.
All growth emanates from a place of rest. Physical growth emanates from a place of rest. Psychological growth emanates from a rest. Well, what do we mean rest? Well, we now know that our work as humans is the work of closeness, of contact, of attachment. That's our work. And so the default setting is to make relationships work, to try to hold on to mommy and daddy, to try to preserve the connection to peers and so on. For that to be released, for a child to be released, to move on to becoming their own person, for that to be there, somebody has to take responsibility. Children must never work for our love. They must rest in it. But unless the relationship is there, they cannot rest in it. We have gone to a practice of parenting and teaching that makes them work for the contact and closeness. that puts them in charge of the relationship. I can't be your friend if you're going to be like that. Off to your room. I withdraw the invitation to exist in my presence until you come into line. And we make them work at keeping us close. Well, we might get more compliance, but we get a deeply restless child. And we're giving rise to a whole generation of children who are restless to the core. They do not rest. Our yearning as parents and teachers, our yearning as grandparents, our yearning as uncles and aunts, where for our nephews and nieces, whatever it is, but as parents, is our yearning should be is to give them rest. Because when we can give them rest, when they can rest from working at keeping us close, when we take that alpha position and we say, I am the one who is going to make sure that nothing, honey, nothing can separate you from my love. You can rest in it. When we do this, when we don't withdraw our affection or our invitation to exist in our presence when there is a problem, when they are at rest, their developmental destiny will unfold. Their growth will become spontaneous and automatic. I always know when I see a child who is truly growing up, becoming mature, adaptive, emergent, and integrative being, I know that somewhere in their life, someone, an adult, someone the child is attached to deeply and vulnerably, has been able to give them rest. Rest is absolutely essential. One of ways of giving a child rest is to make sure that we provide more than what is they need. You hear sometimes people say, well, don't pay any attention to him. You know, all he wants is attention. What is that? What else is there to want? And if we see a child who wants attention, why wouldn't we give it to them? Why wouldn't we meet these basic needs of affection, of attention, of mattering, of significance? The fact is we must provide more. Those of you who have heard me speak or read in a book, I share this example of Tamara, my oldest. Now, I think she's 37. She's here. I won't ask her. She's 7 years of age. And we had this little interchange, this little I love you thing. She said to me, Daddy, I love you. Had that question mark in the back. It's meant to get an I love you too. It's like a little hook. So I said, I love you too. And then there was this moment of pregnant silence. And she says to me, in childish wisdom, Daddy, if you really loved me, you would have said it first. The males here will recognize this as female logic. But it's true. Now, it didn't mean I had to say it first. But it meant that she was in charge. Do you see that? She was in charge. I needed to seize the lead. The role of the parent is to give more than what is pursued. That is the only way a child can rest.
Boy, there's three or four things I want to get a handle on there. Number one, rest is the only way we grow. I read some research recently. I couldn't put my fingers on it this morning. That actually talk about when we sleep, and talking about 7 to 8 hours a night, not you people that are getting 5 and 6, but people that get 7 and 8, actually toxins in your brain are processed and released. Dreaming's part of that. Other things are part of that. But actually toxins in your brain are scoured out during times of rest. I love the whole Hebrews 3 and 4 thing that God's making clear through the writer of Hebrews that the Sabbath rest was never about a Saturday off. It was about a state of being inside of God where we rest from our own labors. And that you can only enter that rest as you believe Him. And believing Him begins by His work in us. I like what this Gordon Neufeld said about the alpha role. The one who understands love most needs to take the lead in loving. They need to build the relationship. Me and my grandkids, me and my children, me and the next broken person I meet on the street. God and you. He's the one that gets love. And you learn love by being set at rest in it. Almost everything we've talked about religion in the early parts of this podcast and the struggle of ministers in it, the struggle of the institution themselves, those that are leaving it, is because we don't invite people to that engagement of rest. Religion is about how you engage God, how you earn the love of God. And I remember so much, I could feel loved by God when I worked hard enough. And it was all the projection of my own feelings. I worked hard. I had done things God wanted me to do. I'd paid a price for it. So obviously he loved me. And so if blessing came into my life, then yeah, that's proof I'm good. And then when trouble comes into my life, and you can't read the Bible and not know, even if you're loving God and following him well, that trouble is going to come into your life. It's just part of this broken world we live in. But if trouble is the sign that you're not loved, now you end up in a really broken place. Religion teaches us that you've got to earn God's love. And if you don't earn it, he does this stuff like withholds his affection. You know, until you can be better, you can't be in my presence. And we even talk, I hear worship stuff, quote unquote, worship stuff all the time about we got to make ourselves better. We got to pray and confess. We've got to walk our way into this temple. And we've got to earn our way to God. And I think what was expressed in this video clip, this audio clip, is the fact that rest is the only way you grow. Rest begins with what God does. The incarnation was God sharing himself with the world. You are loved and looking to set us at ease in him, even in the broken places of our life, even where we still sin, where we struggle, where we feel berated by loneliness, to know we're at rest in his love. Even in the brokenness of this world, that's why the incarnation, that's why I wrote He Loves Me. That's been the most transforming reality of my life. That's where I sit today in the mess that's Wayne Jacobson's life and the stuff that's coming at me that's hurtful, the things in my life I see not done yet, the places I still hope for. I had dreams and visions of things. I don't mean for myself. I mean for the Church of Jesus Christ in the world that's not there yet. Where I do find rest is knowing I'm loved. And if rest is where we grow, and I think it's probably the most profound statement from this clip, rest is where you grow. If you're not at rest, whether that's sleeping at night and letting your brain being purged, whether it's at rest in a relationship so that every time you're with that person, you're on pins and needles and you're worried and you're trying to figure out what you need and how you get it, manipulate it and all that stuff. Until you're at rest, you don't get to grow. Until you're at rest in God and realize, put the responsibility of this relationship growing on him. That's the whole Engage video series I did, was to get people to realize God's the one who engages us. We're learning to recognize the engagement. We're not trying to earn our way to God. We're not trying to make ourselves acceptable. We're not trying to build the relationship. I love this. I think this resting is our access into the new creation. The way God makes himself known in the world, the way he's made you to be a different person in the world. The reason why, Tom, Eric, we're just like the other institutions, that we're going to get mine, be first, be right, punish the weak, is because we're not at rest in the love of God. So we've still got something to prove, something to gain. And we're trying to protect and sustain. And we use institutions to do everything with the promise that if we do it right, we'll have rest. But the very fact that we're managing it will guarantee that we won't. If you haven't read Hebrews 3 and 4 in a while, read it. The reason we don't enter God's rest is because of unbelief. The more we don't trust him, the more we disobey. And the more we trust in his love and affection and believe in his goodness towards us, the easier it is to follow him. And use that for obedience. If obedience is a bad word, I know some people it is, because it's a bunch of hoops to jump through. Obedience means, to me, I wake up, I look to sense what it is that God may be doing in my life. And when he makes something clear to me, I follow him there. That's obedience. I don't have a list of things that obedience to God means today. Obedience is following, and when you lose confidence in your own labors and rest in his, that's where life really happens. And I just, all the people I've dealt with over years, I like what he said. You can tell when someone's been loved because they live at rest. They learn to adapt. They can navigate the brokenness of life. And when people haven't been loved, I love the word he used, they're restless. They're restless. And that restlessness, it's the worst of what the world does to us. And restfulness is the best that God wants to give us inside of his love and his affection and the knowing of him.
Traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.